It's KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. How do you get your political news? TV, the internet, your social media contacts? But increasingly, people are getting their news, their entertainment, their partisan and policy enlightenment from podcasts. Here's my favorite.
I am Senator Kay Wolf, Kansas State Senator, District 7.
Kay is, of course, a returning voice, a friend of State House Blend, so we're looking for an update. I believe you've got a couple of poodles stashed away there at your house, do you not?
Sam, it's incredible what you research, absolutely.
What are their names, by the way?
Cassandra and Nicole, but short for Nikki and Cassie.
Well,
That's KCUR State House Blend podcast, which I co-host with Sam Zeff, who you heard there, though that's the only one you really should need. It isn't the only political podcast out there. From the comedic take of politically reactive to the wonky statistical approach of 538's elections podcast, today we're talking about all these and more, many more, with the audiophiles, our podcast enthusiasts and critics. It's good to welcome back Kyle J. Smith. Hello, Kyle.
Hi, Brian.
And also Matt Staub.
Good morning.
Good to have you both here. So in this day and age, there's no shortage of places to get information about politics, maybe too many choices. What do podcasts add to the mix that you're just not going to get from other places, Kyle?
Yeah, I often listen to political podcasts in the morning while I'm at the gym. And it's an interesting contrast to listen to what's being said in my ear and to watch CNN on mute on the television screens. Because when I see that, all I see is like a list of things I'm supposed to be infuriated about that day. Mm-hmm. And I appreciate that the podcast I'm listening to is a little bit more reasonable.
More reasonable and maybe more substantial, Matt?
Yeah, I think it's definitely more of that nuance that Kyle references that you don't get when you're watching the soundbite news, but you get more of a conversational style that podcasts, we love the medium for. And it's like sitting in with a conversation with really reasonable, well-minded people talking about really difficult issues.
Obviously, this is an election year. I know some of the podcasts you're going to be mentioning really just started up for this election cycle. Could this be something, though, that provides your political information year in and year out, you think?
Yeah, I've been listening to many of these shows for years. It's a lot more fun right now because it's the sports of the election season. But the policy implications, the day-to-day details, it's always important and it's always useful.
I was thinking about the old adage that you campaign in poetry, but you govern in prose. Do the podcasts work as both prose and poetry?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of that. Some healthy perspective, a look back in history as well.
And we'll look at a couple of those historical ones. Let's go ahead and jump in, actually. And I want to start with the only podcast that both of you named on your list of favorites, at the risk of seeming too self-promoting. It's the NPR Politics Podcast. They do a weekly, or sometimes more often, roundup of what's going on in politics and the campaign, and then some themed special episodes. Here's a bit of a recent one of those on politics and musicals.
But, like, we see all of these moments where the art and the life are buttoned up against each other. When the politics happens in musicals, are the musicals treating politics as a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I don't know if that's quite the right question. I mean, I think it's, politics is sort of a natural subject for a musical or for any sort of stage play or movie, mm-hmm. or whatever, because politics is conflict and conflict drives a story. I mean, conflict is a natural part of politics. It's what makes Evita interesting. It's what makes Angels in America, makes all sorts of things interesting. It's what makes Hamilton interesting. One party fighting against another. It just works.
Yeah.
But when you talk about the musical, it also speaks to a kind of idealism that is frequently, and Bob, I'll turn to you on this, frequently a part of the musical ethos is this super idealism or super romanticized notion of how good things could be.
Oh, absolutely. There's a lovely song from a British musical called Pickwick, called If I Ruled the World. And it was sung by Harry Seacomb, an operatic tenor. And it's just the most lovely song. And he's running for office in this silly Dickensian musical, but he doesn't have any platform. And he just says, well, if I ruled the world.
Every man would be as free as a bird.
It's just
I know that song.
It's really
beautiful
lovely
song.
I mean, what I was thinking about, what Broadway has to offer to politicians is notions of staging and of stardom.
That was the NPR Politics Podcast, a special one on musicals and politics. Not your typical bit of political news, Matt.
No, not at all. But how amazing to hear all those correspondents from NPR talking about something so lovely as, in that context.
Right. You have the political editor, Ron Elving, and the movie critic, Bob Mondello, in the same broadcast or same podcast.
Yeah, and it makes it feel worthwhile now that my girlfriend has turned up Hamilton so loud on so many car rides. I didn't know it would come up like this.
Right, it's like you're listening to the news, basically. Mm-hmm. I mean, what do you guys like about this podcast? What sort of separates it from the pack of people just talking?
Yeah, like I mentioned, when you listen to a show like All Things Considered or Morning Edition, you hear these voices. They're well-reasoned. They're really smart. They're bringing in some great perspectives from their reporting. But you hear them in a vacuum. And it's usually, you know, Stephen Teep asking Sam Sanders, what was your take on this situation? But to hear them all together asking questions of each other, challenging each other, and being conversational, showing their personalities, it's like sitting in the room with your favorite NPR reporters and getting some really deep perspectives. It's really fun.
Well, obviously, a lot of these podcasts deal with the current events, the things going on day to day in the campaign. But some of them actually look back and try to tell a little bit of the history. One of your favorites, Matt, is one called Whistle Stop. Tell us a little bit about this podcast.
So I think we both recommended this one. But Whistle Stop is John Dickerson, who hosts Face the Nation, is also on another one of my favorite podcasts. It looks at history through the lens of campaigns since the beginning of the Republic. So the way campaigns have been conducted and the way they parallel now.
I was misspeaking. It was Kyle who I thought I was supposed to turn to for this one.
We're both big fans.
You agree? Yeah. Where does historical – I have to say history doesn't seem like something that a lot of podcast listeners at first glance might be all that interested in spending a lot of time thinking about.
Yeah, there are a lot of great history podcasts out there, but I suppose that's another show. But what I appreciate about listening to these Whistle Stop stories is they're a little bit more comfortable than listening to the current news because you know how it ends. And when you think about what's going on right now, there's some doom and gloom out there. And it's good to know that, you know, we've done it before and we made it through other hard situations. So we may just make it through this election season, too.
Well, let's get a little taste of what that sounds like. This is the podcast Whistle Stop.
But the other interesting thing about Kennedy's announcement on January 2nd, 1960, was he did it in the Senate caucus room. In this age of the outsider, candidates announced their campaigns at nearly the furthest physical location from that dirty Congress where liberties of the nation are strangled and people's hopes are repeatedly trampled. Also, it was on a Saturday. Who does that? Nobody's watching cable on Saturday. Nobody's watching broadcast television. Well, back in 1960, people read their Sunday papers. And if you wanted to get good placement in the Sunday papers, you did your announcing on a Saturday. Kennedy laid down the gauntlet in this announcement to his opponents, saying the Democratic primary elections were the true testing ground for the candidates, saying those seeking to compete with him should do so in the primaries. He specifically mentioned Senators Lyndon Johnson of Texas and Stuart Symington of Missouri, suggesting that if his rivals couldn't beat him in the primaries, they wouldn't be able to beat Nixon in the fall. Nice try, Senator. Kennedy was trying to change the playing field for the nomination, saying that the primaries were the thing, not the views of the old bulls and party bosses, who preferred those other candidates he had mentioned. Kennedy's hope was that through victories, he could create a national movement for his candidacy, but also raise his stature. Many of the old school Democrats still believed he was too young, too Catholic, and too inexperienced to receive his party's nomination. At 42, he was the youngest presidential candidate in U.S. history. Obama used the process to elevate himself in a similar way, David Axelrod writes in his book about that campaign. In a memo he wrote to Obama, he said, "The campaign itself is also a proving ground for strength. How you respond to the inevitable challenges you'll face will reveal much about your strength and preparedness for the job." So hurl yourself into a campaign, and then when you handle the craziness, people will think, oh, well, he may never have run anything in his life, but he's doing okay running his campaign.
That's Whistle Stop, the podcast. You know, guys, one of the things that stands out to me about a lot of these podcasts is that they have a lot of substance. Obviously, there was a great deal of substance even in that clip we heard, but there's also a tone that it seems like podcast hosts can effect that's a little different than what if they were NPR reporters. There's just a hint of snark.
Yeah, sure. I often find myself laughing out loud while I'm listening to podcasts, which must scare everyone else at the gym in the morning.
Like, what is he laughing about? Well, let's turn to one of your favorites, Matt. You know, that was a look backward at history, but a lot of podcasts focus on the present and sometimes on things that the soundbite journalism you mentioned just can't really bring out.
Yeah, when you look at the kind of the horse race and here's what happened on what day, it fails to get into really the deep policy implications of all of that, and to really pick apart a piece of policy and dig into it is hard to find.
So one of those that tries to do that is one put out by the website Vox. Mm-hmm. Tell us about The Weeds.
The Weeds is exactly what you would expect from a name like The Weeds. They get into the weeds. They pick a couple of themes, usually maybe just one or a research paper, and really pick it apart and talk about the implications and the unintended consequences and the history of the politics that went into the policy. So really getting into the weeds.
Well, let's take a listen to what The Weeds sound like when you're talking about something like, oh, welfare reform.
But I think the reason I was interested in talking about it today is also that welfare reform is an interesting policy in that the two parties' view of it has really diverged. So in 1996, when the bill passes, and we should talk a little bit about the circumstances of that passage, but in 1996, when the bill passes, it is something that both sides view a little tepidly. Bill Clinton gives his speech talking about its passage. He had vetoed earlier versions of this bill. And he says in the speech, some parts of this bill still go too far. The bill still cuts deeper than it should in nutritional assistance, mostly for working families and children. So he kind of says, look, I'm signing this, but I don't think it's great. It's just better than not signing it. And Republicans, too, they wanted something much stronger, much tougher. They wanted to take that model and bring it to Medicaid and food stamps. They were happy they got movement here, but they did not get everything they wanted. We are now roughly 20 years later, and welfare reform has gone from something that I think certainly in the early 2000s, both sides saw as a pretty big achievement. Bill Clinton even published a New York Times op-ed touting the success of welfare reform, to now it's something that Republicans are using as the model for virtually all of their major policy reforms. And Democrats are really abandoning. Senator Sanders has been very critical of welfare reform. He opposed it at the time. He opposes it now. And Hillary Clinton has been, you know, fairly upfront that she thinks it's been quite flawed, particularly, she would argue, I think, in implementation. But more broadly, my sense of the currents in the Democratic Party around this are that welfare reform is increasingly looked at as a poor policy. Maybe not a mistake to reform welfare. A lot of people think that was needed. I'm probably one of them. But what was actually done was not a good bill. And the reason I think a lot of folks have come to that conclusion is the Great Recession. That a lot of the problems of welfare reform were masked by the incredibly strong labor market of the 1990s.
That's the podcast, The Weeds, from Vox. And Matt Staub, I have to ask, when they said early in that podcast, welfare reform policy is really interesting. I may not have been the only person who said out loud, is it?
Yeah, well, I apologize if anyone's sleeping out there after that. it is something you have to be in the right mindset for sure. But I find that there's always an oversimplification in everything. And to really understand the nuances, even though it makes it more difficult to actually live your life and know what's right and wrong, to realize that there really is a complicated thing and that in politics there's a lot of compromise and there's an effort to do what's best. And maybe it actually reduces your cynicism and gives you some trust in the system a little bit.
And if welfare reform does pique your interest, the most recent episode of 99% Invisible is about it. So you can go learn more there. Matt, I have a question for you.
Yeah.
In The Weeds, they go into the weeds about policy. Have they been doing that with the policies that Hillary and Trump have outlined on their website?
Yeah, a little bit. I think that they are inspired by some of the hot topics happening right now. So it kind of goes over the place. When there's new and startling research out, they'll kind of react to that. So it is reactive to the times. They're looking at a historic and current perspective.
So have they handled the criticism of Trump that he doesn't have policy? Is that something they've talked about?
They don't get so much into the analysis of the candidates. They get more into the analysis of the policy. But they will say, well, we haven't heard from a certain candidate on this, or it's incoherent where this might take us.
And speaking of incoherence, I mean, one of the things that podcasts can do is sort of raise up either partisan politics or policy matters in ways that make people chuckle, make people laugh out loud, as you said, Kyle. One of those that I know you like is called Politically Reactive. What's that about?
Politically Reactive is hosted by W. Kamau Bell and Hari Kondabolu, and they're both comedians, but are also very well versed in politics. So they're using this show to laugh and also discuss politics and to bring in some experts to dig a little bit deeper into the issues.
How did you become aware of this podcast?
I think I was familiar with both of them as comedians first, so I knew I could laugh with them. And when I learned that they were going to be talking about politics, I thought, oh, I'd tune in and keep up with that.
Well, one of the accusations that has sometimes been made about political rhetoric in this campaign season is that it's dog whistling, that it's calling people out to using code words or using short and incomplete language. These two comedians on Politically Reactive talked a little bit about that. Here's a clip.
So George Wallace gets elected to be governor of Alabama in 1962 by being this staunch segregationist, even though he had been a racial moderate. Being a racial moderate didn't work for getting elected, so he became this racial firebrand. But at the same time, he's elected in 1962, and nationally he becomes a bit of a laughingstock because here he comes to personify the sort of red-faced, bellowing, spittle-laced Southern politician spewing hatred about blacks. And he begins another shift, where he begins to shift away from white supremacy today, tomorrow, and forever to states' rights and freedom of association, these coded terms. He's really pioneering the expression of white supremacy in coded terms that can be defended as race neutral. And here's another thing he pioneers that is completely pertinent to Donald Trump. He pioneers the idea that you can flip the script on people who accuse you of racism, and you can accuse them of being the real racist for mentioning race.
What? That, oh, my so, God, that came from George Wallace?
That comes from George
Wallace. I thought
that
Wallace. Came from
Reddit. Yeah, no. It's popular there now. But yeah. George Wallace in 1968 starts saying, you know who the biggest bigots in the world are? They're the ones who accuse others of being bigots.
So is Donald Trump modern-day George Wallace?
Very much so. Not just in the sense that he's engaging in race baiting, but in the sense that he is also something of a social moderate who's shifting to the right because it's effective. He comes across as a immigrant bashing carnival barker.
Yeah.
Okay, I got that. That's not who he is in fact. In fact, he's a thoughtful, strategic business person who excels at selling things to the public by giving them what they want. And what do they want?
That's the Politically Reactive podcast. Kyle J. Smith, those are comedians, but they're having a pretty serious conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think they're able to do that because they are comedians, because they mix it in with laughter. And they're, like we were saying earlier, very reasonable about it, too. So you're able to talk about difficult things like race and, you know, enjoy it. Get something out of it.
You know, I'm struck listening to that podcast and then looking over the list of some of the others that are out there. The Slate, the online magazine, has something called the Trump Cast, which is probably a good example of the fact that a lot of these podcasts have a left-leaning slant. Do podcasts exist across the whole political spectrum?
I think definitely. I think maybe podcasts are somewhat of an answer to the right-wing talk radio movement. I think maybe podcasts have...
Because there's never really been an equivalent left-wing radio movement. Nothing has had the kind of grasp.
Right. They tried with Air America and Al Franken before he became a senator, but it didn't really take off in the same way. But I think that it's more reasonable. Typically journalists and media elites are more liberal, so that's where we're coming from. But I don't think any of the shows are overtly politically partisan. That doesn't mean that there isn't some partisan bend in some of them.
I think that's probably safe to say. So we've been dwelling in the realm of the real world, but some political podcasts take us to a place that blends the real world with fiction, including one that has been a real surprise hit this year. That's the West Wing Weekly podcast. Tell us about that, Matt.
Yeah, anyone that's a big political nerd like I am loves The West Wing. I scarcely watch TV, but I would never miss the opportunity to watch The West Wing. It's such a fantastic and heralded show that still, I think, 15 years later is hugely popular. And what they're doing with West Wing Weekly is going back through the show all this time later and examining both the craft of the story and the relevance to politics today. So it's a pretty interesting fiction meets reality.
One episode of the podcast for each episode of the TV program.
Right, so you got a 2-hour commitment every time you want to.
Unless you know the TV program so well that you don't need to watch them again, I'm going to have to admit I'm in that category. This clip that we're going to hear is from the episode evaluating Take This Sabbath Day, which was an episode where President Bartlet and his staff agonize over how to save a man from the execution chamber.
put to death, I don't think is ever mentioned in this episode, which is not to fault the episode. The, you know, in a sense, Aaron really focuses more on the morality of taking a human life.
Right, and less about the flaws.
I'm not sure that there's a mention of racial inequity and how the and how capital punishment is handed down as a sentence either.
There is one.
I want you to know that I had a number of people on my staff search for a reason the public would find palatable to commute the sentence. Technicality. Any evidence of racism?
Ah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
But yeah, you're right. They really are talking about the merits of the death penalty with the assumption that the system works and without the caveat that there are fundamental institutional problems with law enforcement and how prosecution and punishment works in this country.
Right. So in a sense, I feel like what Aaron does is to dig into the harder stuff. In other words, he focuses it more on
the morals and not the
process. Yeah, sort of that the gooey part that is a little bit harder for most of us to really get to or to access and is harder to discuss and frame. It's interesting to me that that's how he decides to frame this discussion and through a multi-religious lens.
Yeah. No, that's a great point, that the moral argument for the death penalty is much more complicated than one based on the facts of judicial process.
But the real focus is on, is vengeance even something we as a society should be in the business of? And is taking a life something that's ever okay?
That's the West Wing Weekly podcast, a conversation there between Rishi K. Sherway and Joshua Malina, who played Will Bailey on the original show. One of my favorites, too. We're almost out of time, guys, but what are a couple other podcasts that you would just encourage folks to check out from wherever they get their podcasts? Kyle J. Smith.
I'm excited to keep up with Politics Inside Out. So that's from NPR's Marketplace, and they're going to take a look at politics as inside and out as opposed to left and right, which is a perspective I'm interested in learning more about. And also, we'll definitely be tuning into the show In the Thick, which is the panel is always journalists who are people of color discussing the election season. And I definitely turn to politics, or excuse me, to podcasts to hear perspective very different from my own.
And Matt Staub.
Yeah, I'll do another Marketplace podcast, Uncertain Hour. We mentioned welfare reform. They did a whole series about that process, what it's meant, what it's really been in practice. Its theme is deep looks into the things we fight about the most but understand the least. And I think that's a really useful thing for all of us to listen to.
Matt Staub and Kyle J. Smith are audiophiles with the best in political podcasts. Thank you both for being here.
Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
When we come back, KCUR Central Standard will turn from political podcasts to our favorite music podcasts. Ghost Notes brings us a look at your friend. I'm Brian Ellison. I want to be your friend. Don't go away.